What we want to look at here is to shift gears and look at an evidence apologetics, the apologetic angle that is strongly emphasized in the scriptures. This is one here as part of the overview for this, that we'll look at some of the verses and really see that the God of the Bible puts a lot of weight on fulfilled prophecy. And again, as one thing we need to do is to contrast, like we did in the previous talk and with science, contrast what we're looking at in the Bible as prophecy with that which we see in other sacred writings. Not only the area of prophecy, but also the methods that other cultures use to determine the will of the God, be the way of wording it. Back in the ancient Near East, this whole idea of prophecy was a huge area. Bob can pull down A. If we look at this whole idea of discerning the will of God, remember, if you're living in a culture where there are thousands of gods, they're in control of absolutely everything that you see and touch, it's very important that you be on their right side. So that one of them doesn't get angry at you and decide to knock you off or make you sick or something like that. So it's very important to have a good feel on the will of the gods and what's the best thing to be doing. Ancient Near East divination and magic were dominant features, especially at the higher level you got, the more important these things were. The level of the king and the nation, they were really dominant features in controlling what he did. An example of this we see in Ezekiel 21. Kind of joke, I spent a year studying the exegesis of this verse. Akkadian text, 30%, about 30% of the Akkadian text that we have from Ashurbanipal's library in Assyria are divination and omen texts that he was using to determine the will of the gods. And here in Ezekiel 21, we see this is Sennacherib who's trying to decide where he should attack in one of his western campaigns. And Ezekiel says, "So the king of Babylon stands at the parting of the way, at the head of the two ways." This is on a major caravan route in Syria. "He uses divination. He shakes the arrows. He consults the household idols, and he looks at the liver." I spent a year reading liver divination tests as part of introductory Akkadian, where, they would basically kill an animal, open it up, look at its guts, and by the shape of the liver, determine what, the individual should do. This is, liver looking is the informal English word to use. And God says here, he says into his right hand, which is the good side, the left hand is the bad side. "Into his right hand came the divination Jerusalem. Set battering rams, to open the mouth of the slaughter, to lift up the voice of the battle cry, and so on." So the king of Babylon, in deciding foreign policy, in deciding whether he should get up out of bed in the morning, all features of his life were controlled by divination. Throwing arrows to the ground to see which direction they would fall, consulting kerosene and household idols, and opening up animals to look at the layout of their internal organs to determine the will of the God. This was the dominant feature in the ruling of the ancient Near East. To go back to the other overhead, again, this was a dominant feature, a critical feature, and it really, if we want to get a viewpoint for how it was viewed, divination and omen and such, it was viewed at the same level as we would view science today. I think Ashurbanipal and contemporaries would be really shocked to see that we do not do this kind of stuff. It's a completely different worldview that we just kind of go about our business without being concerned to be using the knowledge that they have spent a lot of time and thousands of years to build this database of liver information that we don't use today. We've thrown out a whole area of study as invalid that they spend a lot of time on. So again, this is a critical area, and to contrast biblical prophecy with astrology and witchcraft, which are the closest carryovers from ancient will discerning that have survived till today. So if we look at it closely then, this prophecy issue is a big one. And another thing is not only the methods used for discerning the will of the gods and the difference between the two, but also we can use the area of prophecy as a test to compare the validity of Christianity, the Old Testament scriptures, with that of other religious works. And this is, again, a very powerful means to be using. An example, I go into this in the chapter in Evidence for Faith on Fulfilled Prophecy. But just to give you an example here, this is a very good truth test for using for other religions. If you look at the Book of Mormon, for example, we can see the attempt to use prophecy to verify Mormonism from the standpoint of, this is from the flyleaf of the softbound edition Book of Mormon, where they're toting here the prophecy argument for Mormonism, saying that in the Book of Mormon, we see America's history foretold 2,500 years ago. Reference to First Nephi here, where we see prophecy about Columbus discovering the New World, that the Indians would be killed off by the settlers, that a group of religious people would come to first settle the New World in the Puritans, that there would be a revolutionary war to free the New World from the old. We see prophecies about this in the Book of Mormon. Well, how valid are they? Critical thing in evaluating prophecy is to, you have to make sure that the prophecy was given before the fulfillment. Otherwise, you know, you're kind of faking it. Just call it a prediction if, you were really written after the fact. And in the Book of Mormon, this is the biggest problem with the Book of Mormon is, well, they claim a 2,500 years before the events actually took place, the first actual public distribution of the Book of Mormon occurred after 1830. Joseph Smith first ran into the Golden Tablets in 1827 and first published them in 1830. So predictions about Columbus, the Revolutionary War, things like that, don't strike us as that significant because it's first disseminated well after those events have known to have been take place. If the Book of Mormon had predictions about the coming of the atomic bomb, about World War II or something like that, then we might evaluate it more significantly. So the prophecy argument is used by other religious groups, but we need to look and see in evaluating that just how good is their prophetic base. How many prophecies are they claiming where the prediction is clearly made before the event was fulfilled? So that's our overview. Again, the contrast between biblical prophecy and that we see going on in other cultures, and then the test for genuine predictions as well are the prophecies that we find in other religious works on occasion, are they really genuine or not? We need to ask that of the scriptures as well. Are the predictions really genuine or not? That's a valid critique that we have to be able to take as well. Another area in looking at fulfilled prophecy, and this is a danger area, I would say, is that we need to watch out for overreading current events. If you listen to Christian radio, there's a couple of shows out there where they're really overreading, I think, end-time prophecy to give us this, the urgency of Christ's return. Look at all these things that are about to be fulfilled that we see happening. And that's a danger, I think, that we can run into in the prophetic world. The Late Great Planet Earth, I think, is an example of that type of book that's looking at contemporary events and saying, oh, look at how everything's being set up for Armageddon and the world to come to an end. And yet in 10 or 20 years, when the predictions that he makes based on his reading don't come to pass, that can shake a lot of people up. So when we're using fulfilled prophecy as an apologetic, make sure we're working with fulfilled prophecy, not prophecy about to take place. Okay, I think we can throw people off by getting too caught up in things that are about to be fulfilled and using that as an argument. Again, from the scriptural standpoint, fulfilled prophecy, I think, is the strongest test that we've got for religious truth. And that it is, and the verse here in 2 Peter, I think, is really a strong one for us to keep in mind, both for our own faith and in witnessing to others. Peter here says, in contrast to the Book of Mormon, we did not follow cleverly devised tales when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. Okay, so here's eyewitness testimony to probably one of the most incredible religious experiences anyone has had. For when he receives honor and glory from God the Father, the Transfiguration, when Peter and Paul and John were there, such an utterance as this was made to him by the majestic glory. This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. So go back and think of that. If I were there and saw Jesus turn from an ordinary man and start to glow with the glory of God and have God the Father say, "This is my Son," pay attention to what he's saying. What religious experience could I ever have would be more powerful than that? And yet he says, we ourselves heard this utterance made from heaven. We're not taking anyone else's word for it. We were there when we were with him on the holy mountain. And what does he conclude from that? He says, and so we have the prophetic word made more sure. What's he referring to? He's referring to all the prophecies in Isaiah and in the Psalms and so on about a Messiah who's going to come to redeem and rescue his people. But the religious experience he has verifies the prophecy and the predictions made about a Messiah coming. That's what he puts his weight on. Not only the religious experience he's had, but the prophecy that was there hundreds of years before Peter was even born that backed up the idea of a Messiah coming. So that's what he's grounding his faith on. And then he says, to which we who weren't there, do well to pay attention to. Pay attention to that prophetic word, to the prophecies that are there that we have seen fulfilled in history. We should pay attention to those as to a lamp shining in a dark place till the day dawns and the morning star rises in our heart. So again, the importance of prophecy in backing up religious experience and backing up the validity of the Christian faith is really a critical argument to have in place in our own faith and when we're witnessing to others. But this stuff just didn't come out of nowhere, but there's an interaction of God within history that we can look at for verifying that God is really in control of history and in control of our lives. This is emphasized in the Old Testament as well. Deuteronomy 18 is a nice one in showing the contrast between Israel and the other nations. God says here, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not learn to imitate the detestable things of those nations. It shall not be found among you anyone who does, he lists all the things, divination, witchcraft, omens, sorcerers, people who cast spells, call up the dead, all these things which other people are doing to try to discern the will of the God. God says, don't touch it. Kill people who do things like that. Instead, if you want to know what I want you to be doing, pay attention to the prophets that I send you. I'll raise up prophets from among your countrymen. I'll put my words in his mouth. He will speak to you clearly, and he'll speak to you what I command him. So you won't have to be looking at livers and arrows on the ground to discern my will. Someone will tell you in Hebrew what you should be doing. He says, and then people say, okay, well, how do we know? Just because a guy comes along and starts speaking to us, this is what God wants you to do. How do we know that he's really speaking God's word? We need to look at the tradition that the person makes. If the prophet should speak a word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, first of all, get rid of him. So if a guy makes a mistake claiming to be one of my prophets, he should die. How do I know that? How do I know that these people who are coming are really prophets from God, not speaking their own ideas? Here's the test. If he speaks in the name of the Lord and the thing that he says does not come about or come true, then his message that comes with that is something that God hasn't given. So the idea of making a prediction about the future and seeing whether or not that comes true as a basis for whether that prophet is really from God, whether his message should be obeyed, this is the crucial test that God is giving us for discerning his will coming through people to it. Not through omens, not through witchcraft, but through prophets who, as part of their message, will predict things about the future that we can test. If those things come true, then we know that the rest of their message is correct. If the things that they predict have not come true, they're still alive, we should take care of them. And if they're not alive, then we don't need to bother to pay attention to them. So again, the predictive element is a key thing in verifying the truth of Revelation. We see this also in Isaiah's excellent verse for pushing this idea in contrast to the God of the Scriptures, with that in other religions. He says, Isaiah says here to other gods, he says, bring forth his case and bring your strong argument. Let them bring forth and declare to us what is going to take place. As for the former events, declare what they were that we may consider them. But declare the things that are going to come afterward that we may know that you are God. That's the key point in prophecy. This is how you know who's really a God out there and who's not. Who can predict the future that we can look and see what is going to take place and on the basis of that decide whether they're God or not. Indeed, do good or evil that we may anxiously look about what's going to be. So again, the predictive aspect of prophecy is the key thing that we need to be looking for. Isaiah 44, I guess I don't have an overhead for that one. So in apologetics then, this is the key thing that we should be using and looking at prophecy for, is looking for predictions that have been fulfilled that allow us to verify the rest of the content of the scriptures then as being from God. We find predictions in there that are solid and that have clearly taken place after the prediction was made, not like the Book of Mormon, where, the book published in 1830 predicting the Revolutionary War. We have predictions in the Old Testament that are fulfilled a long time after we know that the book was given. Then we have evidence. That's the type of evidence God wants us to be using to discern the spiritual truth from the spiritual error that's out there. So I want to look now then at some examples that we can use in witnessing with people. And I'm going to limit myself again to the situations where it's very clear that the fulfillment came long after this prediction was made. That's, most of the scriptures were given with shorter range prophecies so that people contemporary to the prophet could evaluate this message and determine whether it was true. But there are ones where the prediction was made hundreds of years after the prophecy that we can use today in working with people, and they can't pull the thing, well, that happened. You're basing your date on a conservative date where a liberal date for the scriptures would place it after the fulfillment. So that's one aspect that I'm looking to avoid in the examples that we'll be looking at. And also the examples, again, in the evidence for Facebook as well that I used are avoiding that issue. What I want to look at here is one type of prophecy, the fate of some ancient cities. One advantage of these is, and the ones that I use here, are to look at pairs of cities where a prediction is made about, for example, Minneapolis, and then another prediction is made about St. Paul. And the two cities are fairly close together to each other. And it would be easy if the prophet got the name switched. For example, he got St. Paul, prophecy made about St. Paul that was very severe. And prophecy made about Minneapolis that was very mild. If the city names were flipped, it would be very clear that the prediction was incorrect. We had the same situation in some ancient ones, where, again, a severe prophecy was made against one city, very mild prophecy was made against another city, and we can compare what happened to the two cities and see what happened to them. And again, if the severe one, if the names had been switched in the prediction, we could very clearly tell that they hadn't taken place. The example I want to take a look at here is the prophecies regarding the two Egyptian cities of Thebes and Memphis. These are given by the prophet Ezekiel in chapter 30, verses 13 to 16, where he says, "Thus says the Lord God, I will also destroy the idols and make the images cease from Memphis. There will no longer be a prince in the land of Egypt, and I will put fear in the land of Egypt. I will make Patros desolate and set a fire in Zone, and execute judgments on Thebes, pour out my wrath on Sin, the stronghold of Egypt. I will also cut off the multitude of Thebes and set a fire in Egypt," and so on. We're going to take a look at here the two aspects of the prophecy. One is regarding Memphis, that he said that the idols and the images would cease to exist. And regarding Thebes, he explicitly says that he would cut off the multitude of Thebes. So here's Ezekiel again making two different predictions about two major cities in Egypt. We want to take a look and see how these are fulfilled over time. Just to give us a map to place the world situation, Egypt was mainly constructed or populated along the Nile River. The only real source of water there, and if you're not within a couple miles of the Nile, you don't have any water to live, so this is a major population concentration. Memphis was the major capital city in the Northern Kingdom, the seat of the pharaohs throughout most of the dynastic reign of the pharaohs. Thebes was the twin city or the second capital city for the Egyptian kingdom. It's often referred to as the northern or the southern kingdom of the Nile. The two are united under the pharaohs, with Thebes being the southern capital, Memphis being the northern. In later times, the city Alexandria up on the coast became a major port city for contact with the Greek and Roman world. But in the time of Ezekiel, most of the Mediterranean trade was not so great. Most of the culture was immediately along the Nile, concentrated at the two cities of Thebes and Memphis. So what happened in these cities over time? Well, if we look and date Ezekiel somewhere around 700 BC or something like that, around the time of the fall of the Northern Kingdom, and then we take a liberal date for Ezekiel at around 200 BC or something like that would be the most liberal date I've come up with for that, because we find it in the Dead Sea Scrolls, so it had to be around before the time of Christ. So we need to be looking at predictions in Ezekiel that were fulfilled well after or about the time of Christ, because we clearly know that everything we had it written by that time. The Thebes and Memphis ones are nice in that situation because that's how everything fell out. At about the time of Christ, Memphis was still a major city in Egypt. It was about the size of Alexandria, which was a major coastal city, and Strabo, who is a Greek historian who traveled the Near East at about the time of Christ, goes into a lengthy description of the city. Its culture is considered one of the real cultural centers of the Near East. The many temples that were still in existence and were going at the time, it was a very pantheistic culture in Egypt. And that was basically the lay of the land in Egypt at the time of Christ. It was well populated, big city, all the temples were going to be going.
Christianity came in the second and third century and became very big, but it wasn't really until the time of Islam that we start to see the prediction beginning to be fulfilled. What happened that was interesting with Memphis is that the Muslim leaders came in from Arabia and besieged the city. After they conquered Egypt, however, they did not want to move in and take over the towns in Egypt. It was quite a prosperous area, considered rather pagan and prosperous. So the leaders then did not want the soldiers to be moving into town and being secularized and idolatrized by the local culture. So they had everyone stay in the military camp in which they had settled to besiege the city. They also was a codicil that they did not want, I've inverted the order here, sorry about that. They also did not want water to come between them and the Arab homeland. For a pilgrimage to Mecca, they didn't want people to have to cross over the Nile River. So Memphis is mainly located on the western side of the Nile. So the Arab conquerors came in and stayed on the eastern side of the Nile, and also did not move into town, but stayed in the encampment from which they had besieged the city. That's the next section down the overhead. That encampment that they settled at was about 12 miles away from where Memphis was, and that's basically where the population moved to over the centuries that followed. The conquerors came in and settled on the eastern side of the Nile, about 10 miles away, and if that's where the money is, and that's where the business is, that's where basically the population of Memphis migrated to over the course of the 19th century. Once Memphis was abandoned significantly, then people began to go back to that older city and quarry it for stone to build buildings in what has now become Cairo. So ancient Memphis then, if we go to try to find it today, is basically an abandoned city. There's actually a clear spot because all the stone that was there was used to build the new city of Cairo. I've got an overhead that's different. Yeah, that one we don't, you know, skip over that one. The modern name for this site around Memphis is Saqqara, and this is just a description here that says not all that survives today of Memphis is some of the stone foundation of the original city. So what basically happened here is a city that would be viewed like New York or Washington, D.C. has been dismantled and used for quarry material to build a new town not 12 miles away. Petrie did some excavation of the site around the turn of the century, around 1910. This is one of the photographs from his time. Again, he had to dig below the water level in order to find any appreciable remains because the local people had hauled off everything that had remained from Memphis to be building Cairo nearby. As far as the idols and images of ancient Memphis, they basically suffered the same fate. They've been used as building materials in making Cairo. The only thing that's really left on the site today is one Sphinx statue of Ramses II that's there, and some pieces that are in the museum. The time of Christ. So again, Memphis, if we look at what happened to it, God said he would destroy the idols and make the images cease that were there. He did that by having the town be dismantled and used as a quarry for building another city. Take a look at Thebes in contrast to that and see what happened there. Again, by the time of Christ, Thebes was still going reasonably strong in that time period. In 92 BC, it was able to withstand a 3-year siege from some of the Ptolemies that were trying to attack it. Finally, during the reign of Augustus, the city of Thebes was finally crushed and destroyed in a tax insurrection that took place during his reign. After that point in time, though, Thebes never really recovered as a major population center. If we look at it today, the biggest city in the area is Luxor, which is of reasonable size, but again, nothing compared to the size that was there in the ancient time. What's interesting, though, as part of the contrast, is you can pull up the map or see, is that the ruins are largely intact at sea. In fact, other than for the Sphinx and the pyramids from northern Egypt that we see, all the other monumental artwork in Egypt comes from the area around Thebes. The Valley of the Kings, the vast funerary of things that are built there, the Karnak temples and such, that's all the remains of ancient Thebes. So it's been depopulated. There's a few villages there now. But all the idols and the temples are still in place. All God said he would do to Thebes is depopulated. To Memphis, he said, I'm going to get rid of those idols. Well, what happened? Memphis is gone. Thebes is still there. The idols are still in Thebes, but they're not there in Memphis. Again, this contrast between what he said he would do to one town, what he said he would do to another, that has been fulfilled, and we can see, you know, it's still fulfilled today, over the course of, you know, 2,000 years later, is really, I think, a striking fulfilled prophecy for us to be aware of. Okay. Now, I lost my, buried my overhead, if you let me dig it back. Okay. The other ones that I'll just mention here in the course of the talk, and again, I spend more time on the talk, this Tyre and Sidon prophecy is a very excellent as well in the same way. There's elements to the Tyre prophecy that refer to Nebuchadnezzar coming to conquer and such, which we can't use as a strong apologetic value, again, because of the time of fulfillment issue. Are we sure that we had Ezekiel written before Nebuchadnezzar attacked us? But there are aspects to it about, again, the current situation of the city in contrast to that of Sidon, which was a twin city about 20 miles up the coast, I think is quite interesting. The picture that it would be a place for the study of fishnets, that the city would be leveled and the level spots used for studying fishnets, it would not be a major city anymore. Again, has held true through today. Tyre is basically a fishing village on the coast now. Sidon, that major judgments would be executed against it, but that it would not be decimated and leveled like Tyre had been. Again, another contrasting city prophecy there. Babylon and Nineveh is another prophecy regarding two ancient cities that I discussed in the chapter as well, where, again, a different picture is portrayed about their final devastation that's different. Babylon, that it would be completely uninhabited, that not even animals would be grazed on the site. And Nineveh would be desolate, but the picture of its desolation includes grazing flocks and animals there. And again, that has carried over for thousands of years in the final picture of destruction that these cities have. The Babylonian region does not have the rainfall, does not have the fertility in the soil to give you these grazing conditions, as well as the superstition of the local Arabs that the place is haunted and you don't want to bring your animals into the site. Whereas the site of Nineveh has more rainfall, has a better soil condition, and is therefore used for grazing animals on. That difference in the picture of the two that wouldn't be obvious to a prophet a thousand miles away over in Israel in portraying the final desolation, I think is a point that, again, very long time after the cities were destroyed, the final picture of the desolation agrees with what we see in the Bible. Now, there's objections that people can raise to this that we need to be aware of. People can say, well, yeah, there's been, you know, all kinds of cities destroyed in the past. There might be eager people out there that are just looking to fulfill a prophecy that they see in the Bible and things to that standpoint. And this is where I've tried to pick ones for examples where you can't say that very well. The destruction of Memphis was done by the population moving. It's done by the influence of Islam in the country. Muslims aren't that interested in fulfilling Old Testament prophecies from that standpoint. The final picture desolation that we get at some of these cities is, again, has some striking differences in that between the desolation that one city is portrayed with versus the desolation of another. Something else to realize, though, is that this lots of cities are destroyed argument isn't all that valid. If you travel around out there, there are cities that are still there after thousands of years. Jerusalem is still there after thousands of years. The city of Aleppo, Damascus, and so on in Syria. There is a lot of major cities in the ancient Near East that are still on their original sites that archaeologists really are annoyed at because you can't dig up, you know, downtown Damascus in order to see what was happening there thousands of years ago. So, again, the cities that are destroyed, portrayed as going to be destroyed in the Bible, are destroyed. Cities that are no destruction is mentioned are still there. So again, we see this picture with regard to the future status of cities that has really carried over thousands of years, that I think is a good evidence of showing God working in human history to destroy some towns, to not destroy others, and to leave a picture of desolation that fits that which we see given by the prophets, again, thousands of years before our time. Okay, next area I'd like to look at is one that involves more history of people. And the people of Israel is the area here. And again, this is being drawn from several chapters in Evidence for Faith and several chapters in the book The Evidence of Prophecy as well. So I'll just give you a summary of the evidence that we see in this area. The key thing here is that God portrays several pictures of the nation Israel. The picture of what will happen if they obey him, the picture of what will happen if they disobey him. And the picture of disobedience is what we see fulfilled in the history. Example of this is the Hosea chapter 3 prediction of what the future of Israel is going to be like. We can put up the scripture on that. God tells Hosea to carry out an acted parable in which Hosea, in his relationship to his adulterous wife, Gomer, is a picture of God's relationship to Israel and what their future is going to be. Chapter 3 says, "So love a woman who is loved by her husband," this is his wife Gomer, who's run away from him after being married to him for a while in order to commit adultery. "Love a woman who's loved by her husband, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, even though they turn to other gods and love raising things." So he says, "I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. And then I said, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So will I be toward you." The picture that I see here is that he buys her for himself for a while, but has no relationship with her. "I don't want you running around. I bought you that you don't do that. But I'm not going to have any relationship with you either." And that's the parallel to what God is doing with Israel. The parallel is that the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idol. The contrast I see in this in Israel's history is something that we see fulfilled, that they have gone for many days without having a Davidic king, and yet without having their own nation, without having a civil government as well. That God has allowed them to go for many days without a formal system of sacrifice, like we see in the Old Testament, and without turning aside to idolatry as well. And the God that has allowed them to go for many days without the ephod, the Levitical priesthood, which was killed in 70 AD in the destruction of Jerusalem, and still go for many days without turning aside to divination and all that junk for discerning God's will that we were looking at that was done by other nations. Well, again, Israel has been in this funny state since 70 AD or in some aspects before that, of not having its own nation, of still being a people, of not having a temple in Jerusalem, and not having turned aside to other gods, and not having a priesthood, still not having gone to divination and other ways of trying to determine God's will. So that strange state defined in Hosea is something that, again, is fulfilled in the people of Israel. And yet at the end of that prophecy, in verse 5, he says, afterwards the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. And the fact that Israel has now come back to be a nation after the 1800 years of having been scattered and being a civil without a government, I think is part of this Hosea prophecy. Another aspect of prediction and so on involves the blessings and curses that God has given mainly in Deuteronomy and in the Pentateuch for what has happened to the nation of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 28 is the one I'd like to focus on there as an example. Here he says again, if Israel disobeys, that he would scatter them among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other. But there you will serve other gods, wood and stone, that your fathers have not known. You will have no rest and no resting place for the sole of your foot. The Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, bare of soul. Your life will hang in doubt. In the morning you will say, I wish it were evening. In the evening you will say, I wish it were morning. Now this picture of not having a resting place, of your life being in fear, it's really been pretty much a prediction that we've seen fulfilled in the history of the Jews. You can grab any history and see once the final diaspora started with the fall of Jerusalem, how they've been scattered throughout the world. And Urquhart's book has quite a section on that, The Wonders of Prophecy. I don't know if that's in the bookstore or not. Yeah, a very excellent one, written at the turn of the century before there was any hint that Israel would be reestablished as a nation. Spends a fair amount of time on going over the history of the Jews, their scattering throughout Europe and really throughout most of the world, and showing wherever they've gone, they've been persecuted and been looked down on and been scorned. And, you know, we have the phrase, the wandering Jew, carried over as basically a proverb in English. Again, this whole picture that they would be scattered throughout the world and not have a homeland and not have a place of rest and yet not be assimilated into the world. It's still a group of people that we can look at after 2,000 years and say, these are Jewish people. There's a picture that we see as part of the curses that God would put on the people of Israel for disobedience. Again, a fulfillment, a prediction made that's fulfilled in our time that we can trace through history clearly after it was given. The third aspect of history for Israel is the regathering, as I mentioned before. At the turn of the century, it's kind of interesting to read Urquhart and see if you catch gleams of that in his wording, how he looks at the land of Palestine at the turn of the century and sees how it's a desolation. The land is just barely inhabited by some Bedouin. He says, it's interesting that the land of Israel is portrayed as a desolation as part of God's curse in throwing the Israelites out. And then he also goes on to mention how really it's, you know, it looks like it's ripe for their return to the land, but there's no real hint that they would be heading back that way. And the real drive to have the Israelites or the Jews return to Israel really started to come in the past 100 years or so. There was an expulsion of the Jews from Russia at the end of the last century by the Tsars that started to drive Jews back to Palestine. It was finally through the British taking over Palestine at the turn of the century, especially after World War I, where the land became fairly safe for Jews to go back to, where they wouldn't be persecuted by the Arabs and the Turks that were ruling the country. And that was accelerated with the Holocaust. and the persecution of the Jews during World War II in Poland and Germany. Finally, the Jews said, we've had enough, we need to get back to a central government where we can have our own defense. And that drive for their own defense is what finally brought them all back, most of them back to Israel, so they can have planes with the Star of David on them and not have to count on some other government to defend them. So again, the fact that Israel has stayed as a nation, has stayed as a distinct people group for thousands of years, and now has come back to their homeland, I believe is a really unique portrayal of a fulfilled prophecy, a prediction that God would bring them back. That prediction is not only in Hosea, but is also in Isaiah 11. And there's a chapter in the Evidence of Prophecy book that really covers this in detail. But God says through Isaiah, when he's speaking in the sense of looking at that first dispersion where the Syrian Babylon come and deport a reasonable chunk of the population off to Assyrian Babylon, Isaiah is looking beyond that first return, which occurred with Nehemiah at that time, looking beyond to a second return, where he will again bring people back, not only from the land that they've gone to, but also notice there from the islands of the sea, that he'll lift up a standard for the nations and bring back the Jews from the four corners of the earth. He'll bring them back from a worldwide gathering back to his homeland of Israel. So again, the Isaiah prophecy here, the Hosea prophecy, that after those days of not having a king or prince, sacrifice or pillar, ephod or teraphim, that he will bring them back, we've seen fulfilled starting in our century. And I think that is a very powerful argument to be using with someone in this realm of fulfilled prophecy. Look at the nation Israel. How did that get there? Well, God predicted that he would keep his people together and then bring them back. And that's what we've seen happen. So to summarize this area, again, I mentioned that really, and this is an area we could spend hours and hours on, and I really enjoy it, to see how God has worked in history to bring his purposes to pass. Again, to remind you, this is from the scriptures themselves, this is the strongest argument we can be using with people, is to show that the God that we're, whose scriptures we have, is the God who's working in history to bring his purposes to pass. That, and Peter's example, that Peter grounds his religious experience on the predictions made about the Messiah, that we can trust more than just an internal experience that we may have had. We can trust external fulfillment, external prediction as well. We have an objective basis for belief beyond something subjective that God may have worked in our lives. So I would encourage you then to, that is the next point there, Bob, to grab some of these books and read up on it and kind of do a little history so that both for your own growth and for use with others, to make a couple of these points your own. Go beyond the ones that I've presented here and looked up on. Again, there's a lot of material on this. Josh McDowell, Evidence for Demand for Verdict, has quite a good section on this as well. But it's a very powerful argument that we should be aware of. Then just general points I guess I should make, and this comes from my own work in the area. Very often I've had the approach of looking for the magic bullet. I want to find that argument that I can give to somebody and they'll fall on their knees. Overwhelm them and that'll be it. But I've learned that most situations, that does happen, that most situations don't work that way. That people will continue to have objections, Our goal, though, is to really try to meet them and to find their real roadblocks and get them to the point, as has sometimes happened, where the person will say, I really don't have any objections. I just don't want to believe. Okay. Our goal in witnessing is to get a person to see that it's not for lack of evidence that they're not wanting to accept Christianity. It's because they don't like the message that's there. If we can not turn them off and be tactful and get them to that point, and then pray like crazy that the Lord will overcome their stubbornness, then we're using this type of evidence, I think, in the way God intended us to do so. But we have to remember that there's no magic bullet out there that will do it. Outside of apologetics, there's a realm where you may have seen this. If you ever work with Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, you'll read a passage and you'll think you have the perfect exegesis for why Jesus is really God, okay? And you bring your verse and you read it to them, and they have the perfect reason why that verse does not mean that Jesus is really God, okay? And what you have to do sometimes is say, just because they have an answer to my point doesn't mean that their answer is better than mine. And sometimes you have to just sit on the passage and say, no, let's look at your explanation. Let's look at my explanation. And not play this game of one-upmanship. I've got one verse, you've got another. I've got one verse, you've got another. But stay with what you've got and work with that and say, no, my explanation is really more consistent with the interpretation you're giving to it. And that's part of the wrestling that we need to work with in some of this too, is to say, okay, I'm going to, and some of the things I've tried to do with Pops as well is work back to the ones that are very clear, that have the least objection, and sit on those and say, we've got something really happening here, or God is at work. And there might still be objections to it, but I can be comfortable with those, because I've seen, you know, what the alternative explanations are, and they're not very good. And finally then, really, what people look at when they're looking at us and we're witnessing to them, is they're looking at us. Our words are great, but what's the rest of our testimony like? And if we come in with a great presentation of prophecy, and we're arguing that God is in control of history, this is proof that God is in control of our lives, and we're all bent out of shape when something bad happens to us. What kind of a testimony is that? How much do we believe that God is really in control? Okay? So, this is where apologetics is valuable, strengthening us so that our testimony is better when we're witnessing other people, because people are seeing our whole life. What's our confidence and what's our trust in? This is really striking to me, because this is what shook me up and got me to consider God seriously in the first place. I was in college, and typical secular heathenism. I'd picked as a lab partner in my biochemistry class the cutest girl in the class, and we were working together, and the experiments were falling apart, and we were putting hundreds of hours into these labs, and we're still not getting any results out of it. And I'm the scientist type. I think I'm in control, and nothing's working, and I'm getting blown apart by this. And they're a very solid person, and she's not being shaken up by it. And I'm sitting here like, why does she have this confidence and trust that I don't have? And that's because she was a Christian, okay? And that got to me after a while, in terms of, you know, she's got a different worldview than I have, and being, you know, shaken up and rattled by the difficulty of trying to do experiments. Because she's seen God work in history and in her life in areas to know that everything's working out for a good purpose. She can trust in that even when labs are failing and when other things are falling apart in your life. And it's that aspect of testimony that can really get to people, like it happened to get to me. And that, I think, is the value of apologetics and why we really need to look at this in terms of strengthening our own faith, our own walk with the Lord, so we can handle adverse circumstances, because we have seen Him work in history in objective means. And we can trust Him then when things are going rough for us personally. And that testimony then can really have an impact, can have an effect on those that we're in contact with. So with that, I've come to a close. My watch says that it's 8:30. So I think we're doing all right on that. Sure. parent.
It's interesting, the New Testament, orthopathy is rarely used to say two things about Jesus. And what is really used is that Jesus rose from the dead. And Jesus makes that his principal evidence as well. Do you use that very much? And so how do you go about using that aspect of evidence?
Is Bob going to touch on that?
You're going to touch on that.
Good, okay.
Correct.
Yeah. No, but I think the resurrection is very important. You know, Paul states a lot on that in 1 Corinthians 15, I believe it is there. But to counter that, the person today would say, well, you know, I wasn't there. And I can't go to those eyewitnesses that Paul appealed to. And so therefore, how can I, you know, how can I base my faith on that? Well, I wasn't there. I wasn't a contemporary. So I think that's where I draw from the Peter thing, that we do well to pay attention to the prophecies, because those are the lamps shining in a dark place. Those reach a little bit further than the contemporary events do to be able to check up on.
But on the other hand, a same person will believe in historical events in the past that don't have quite the attestation of the New Testament that the attestation.
Right.
Any of that argument.
Yes, that's right. You can stay with that and say, well, do you believe George Washington existed? And do you believe George Washington fought in the Revolutionary War? Well, yeah, sure, why not? Well, okay, well, did Jesus, you know, exist? I don't know. It's too far back. So I think we'll let Bob carry on with those before I start putting my mouth too much. But, the prophecy aspect, again, you know, we're coming with a battery. We're coming with several lines of evidence. The value of prophecy is that it is objective. You can go back 10 years later and research the history of what happened to some of these cities and see, okay, did that really take place? The resurrection, I think you can view from a historical standpoint and in some of the things you were discussing last night. I think if people could prove archaeologically that Jesus didn't really raise from the dead, then I think it would be on very weak ground for being Christian. So there is a historical, you know, we need to have historicity there. To test to use that as a strong proof, you can get into this if it's too close to the time. We're too far away from the event to work with that.
Questions? How does man have much to do with philosophy?
I didn't mention the Quran in this. I mentioned it in my chapter on the evidence for faith. Quran does not have any prophecy in it. The major emphasis in the Quran is in time, is predictions about what will happen to you if you die and aren't a Muslim. That's the major predictive element in the Quran. There's a verse in there where that explicitly says that Muhammad was sent as a messenger to, and has not given any prophetic signs through it. The Muhammad strategy was to base his message as a continuation of the Old Testament, rather than having his own set of prophecies that we could see fulfilled. So that's a big weakness from Islam, is that they do not have prophecies given by Muhammad that we can check, at least not before we die, to see whether they've been fulfilled. Mormonism is the one group that tries to come closest with some prophecies. Religious group that I'm aware of that tries to evoke prophecy as a backup your claim.
Thank you.